It has been buried for thousands of years. A mystery. A secret. A threshold to the future.
Where'd you find this? I've never seen anything like this.
One man will break the code and open the door.
Well, this should read Stargate. It was in front of us the whole time.
The other will lead the way.
Why are you here?
I'm here in case you succeed.
Jackson's identified the seventh symbol.
Backup storage, reserve power, on.
What is it?
It's your Stargate.
We've opened a doorway to a world we know nothing about.
Beam locked itself onto a point somewhere in the Kalium galaxy.
It's on the other side of the known universe.
Your turn now.
They prepared for danger.
Begin final evacuation.
They expected the unknown.
Stabilizing system.
Initiated commencement sequence.
But they could never have imagined this.
Shoot anything that comes down that ramp.
Your job here is to realign the Stargate. Can you do that or not?
I can't.
What the hell is going on?
My orders were simple. Track down signs of any possible danger. Well, I found some.
I can't make it work without the seventh symbol.
Seven minutes.
Now, the most amazing discovery of our time.
Jackson, wait for me.
Is about to become the most extraordinary adventure of all time. Kurt Russell, James Spader, Jay Davidson. Stargate. A Roland Emmerich film.
Welcome to No Escape from Kurt Russell on the Siskoid Cinema feed, the show that explores the filmography of Kurt Russell and his mystique. I'm Siskoid. The Kurt Russell factor was billed to explain why there are performers who we will gladly see anything they're in, regardless of the movie's synopsis. Because Kurt Russell is that guy for many of us. We're testing out this theory film by film, and today we're going back to 1994 and Stargate. A Roland Emmerich movie, even though he's on Siskoid's personal five worst directors list? Yeah, but Kurt Russell is in it. So to help me discuss this film is the host of the JLI podcast and Once Upon a Geek on this very network, the irredeemable Shag. Hi, Shag.
Give my regards to King Tut, a-hole.
One of the better or the more badass lines in the movie. Before we get into the weeds of this, did you see this movie when it came out?
I did. I saw it in the theater. I don't remember the circumstances of why I went to it, whether it was like I was super anticipating it or, oh, hey, I'm the right age and it's out this week, so let's go. Mm-hmm. I don't know which.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters too, yeah.
For me, and I'm probably showing my hand too early here, I was totally pulled in. Like, I was, and I'll explain my reasons as we go, but this movie totally pulled me in for the ride. Like, I felt like I was being sucked through the Stargate with him. I absolutely enjoyed the whole ride of it.
Did that translate to you watching the TV shows and everything?
Not really, no. First of all, when it premiered, it was on Showtime. You know, I don't know if you remember, the first season or two of Stargate was on Showtime. And so they could have the nudity. And now when you watch the reruns, the nudity's been taken out. But anyway, I couldn't get to the first season or two, so I just didn't watch it until I do the coy advance maneuver with a lot of shows. So I came in at season 9 or 10 when Ben Browder came in, just like I came into X-Files when, you know, Doggett and Reyes took over. And so I always come in whenever they've recast everybody. So now, but I will tell you, and this is going to come up later. I'll save it, but there is a Stargate franchise I'm extremely passionate about, but it's not SG-1, which is what it was based on this film.
SG-1 has like these characters recast as TV actors.
Yep, exactly right.
I've never seen it. I've never seen the show. You said Showtime. We don't have that. You know, Stargate did run on, I don't know, some Canadian channel probably, but I never got into it. Never, I don't know. And the movie itself, which I did see in theaters, left a certain impression on me. I think there's like the visually, there are a lot of things in there that are very memorable. Mm-hmm. Didn't carry me through to like later on. I think by the time Stargate might have been the show,
yeah,
or the shows might have been available, there's so much of it.
Yeah.
It felt like this would be like a giant project. At that time, I would have been like, let's buy all the DVDs. And they were rarely on sale. I don't know. But I've never watched a frame of it.
Well, and to be fair, I should have mentioned, you know, it was on Showtime for like a season or two, and then they canceled it and Sci-Fi Network picked it up. So From then on, it was a Sci-Fi Channel show. And the thing I think that could have dragged you in, but obviously didn't, was that it was kind of the alternative to Star Trek back then. Because the TV series started in 97. So by then, we're into Voyager, right? And and all the various franchises of Stargate went for 14 years. So really, it carried through Voyager, through Enterprise, and then went on for another 6 years with no Star Trek on TV. So it was like, so by the time you got to Enterprise ending, you had Stargate as an alternative. But it was kind of very Star Trek-like. Because it was like every episode, they go to a new planet. You know, they jump through the gate, they go to a new planet, they have to explore, they meet a new culture. So it felt very Star Trek in a lot of ways. And if you were disenfranchised with Voyager, which a lot of people were, Stargate was a great alternative.
Yeah, I'm sure. It wasn't on my radar. And I don't think I was a fan enough of the film. Like I said up front, Roland Emmerich, personal five worst directors.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to fight you on Independence Day and Godzilla and all those. Absolutely. They're terrible. But this one, I think, works. And we're going to get into why.
No, it's definitely one of the better films. Maybe it is possibly his best film. Some would say Independence Day, but I mean, they're clunky in the same way. And I'll talk about the weaknesses, the Roland Emmerich weaknesses in here. But nevertheless, Kurt Russell is in it, and I think possibly saves it for me. Are you a Kurt Russell fan generally?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if there's a person on the planet that says they're not, they're a bald-faced liar. I don't know that I would, like, I don't look in the newspaper, well, the newspaper, God, how old am I? I don't look at the listing of movies and say, okay, oh, Kurt Russell's movie, let's go. But it's like, oh, someone says you want to watch this movie, and I say, oh, Kurt Russell's in it? I'm in, sure, why not? So, yeah, he's absolutely something that, I mean, you just can't help but love. He's always going to play a character that captures your attention. I would say this role is extremely different than anything I've seen him play, but he's always captivating.
Yeah, because I figured you liked him because when I was doing the rounds, who wants which movie? You know, like you had three movies. You're down for three movies.
I don't even remember the other two, and I know you've already reminded me twice, and I've forgotten again.
That's fine. We'll keep it as a surprise,
yes.
And you can show up once a year.
There we go.
On the show with a different one. Okay, guys, if you haven't seen Stargate, we're about to spoil the heck out of it. But broadly, it goes like this. An interstellar teleportation device found in Egypt leads to a planet with humans resembling ancient Egyptians who worship the god Ra. Kurt Russell and James Spader, a soldier and a scientist, of course, are on the advance team that walk through. They free the human slaves they find there and defeat the evil alien pharaoh that's responsible. As short as I can make it.
Oh, absolutely. But it's a fun mixture of an adventure movie, some history with ancient Egyptian culture, and some cool sci-fi stuff. So it's a nice swirl of all of those.
I don't think we see a lot of sci-fi movies that go this route.
Yeah.
It's like two routes, really, that I mean. The gate, you know, like instead of spaceships, we're moving through teleportation wormholes that are just doors. We don't see a lot of that. And we don't see a lot of the use of Egyptian myth and iconography. Like, I was reminded at times of, like, the Fifth Element.
Okay.
Which came later. The Fifth Element had, like, at the beginning, there's, like, pyramids. And there's just, like, an iconography. That's, okay, yeah, I kind of see, like, an Egyptian feeling to it. And then it turns into, like, Mobius. You know, Mobius kind of looking
right.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Like, this movie did it first. And so it's kind of like an Indiana Jones on another planet.
That's one of my notes. It's got a modern day Indiana Jones vibe. You know, I mean, there's a little of archaeology. There's a lot of adventure. There's a lot of not soap opera, but, you know, just the bigger than life adventure that you look at. And you're like, okay, they wouldn't pull that off in real life. But sure, it's an adventure film. Let's go for it.
Yeah. You got like two heroes in this, really. And that's what I found most interesting. Not from a directorial standpoint, of course, but
God.
The way it fell. At the beginning, James Spader is supposed to be your hero.
You think? Yeah, he's your through point, at least in the beginning.
Right,
yeah.
He's your access into this world. And of course, this is one of the Emmerich bugs that I despise, but would not have noticed back in the day, which is the conspiracy theorist is the hero, and he's right. He's right, and that saves the world. What was the Moonfall, the one where the moon attacks the Earth?
What?
That's the latest Roland Emmerich movie.
I checked out after Godzilla, probably, man. Oh, no, that's not true. Okay, hold on. There is one other movie I'll stand up for, Day After Tomorrow. I love that movie, and maybe it's just too much of me as a parent that affects that, but I love that movie.
Yeah, there's nothing like people running away from the cold and then closing a door and the cold doesn't come in, you know? That's the kind of dumb stuff that I expect from him and his writing partner, Dean Devlin, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's stuff like this in here, you know. It's like, how to figure out the symbols. And then somebody's reading a newspaper and the back of the newspaper is a constellation. And he realizes, oh, it's the same shape as a constellation. That's what I read newspapers for. All the constellations are in there, you know. It's just like the connective tissue is pretty weak.
I don't think it's any weaker than any other puzzle box movie or show. Mm. I just think you hate this director, right? But I'm saying I don't think it's any weaker than anything else in other movies. I think you hate this director so much that you're going after certain things that I don't know if that one. There's a lot of stuff I'll agree with you on, but that one I don't know.
Well, the conspiracy theorist as hero at the time, whatever, you know, there's always like the one misunderstood guy who.
Sure.
Yeah, that's just a movie trope. And at that time, it was not particularly annoying. But today, like that Moonfall movie, makes no sense. Of course, the movie makes no sense. But also, the one guy who's right is a conspiracy theorist. And that's like, that was made like a couple years ago. And I just feel, oh, don't do that. But he is a conspiracy theorist himself. You can tell. I mean, this one serious movie, Anonymous, is about the conspiracy theory that Shakespeare didn't write his plays, which is one of the two conspiracies that make me completely furious to even entertain the idea. Like that one and the moon landing being faked.
Oh my gosh.
Those are hot button issues. You want to drive me insane? Bring up those topics. Please, people, that's not an invitation to do that. There is that in him as a director, as a writer, as a person. So seeing it here at the beginning, really, this is one of the very early films and the first one that's, it's kind of a big genre blockbuster. Oh, I went, oh my God, that was in there from the beginning, you know.
Not that I'm trying to argue with you on every point, but the more I think about it, I don't know that Daniel's a conspiracy theorist. I mean, he's postulating a theory about Egyptian stuff. And it's
Chariot of the Gods. That's what he's doing.
Okay.
Which is like a famous conspiracy theory from the 70s, which is what Battlestar Galactica is built on. You know, like I don't have a problem with Chariots of the Gods necessarily. It's just the idea that the conspiracy theorist is also completely correct.
Okay. But at no point does he say it's aliens. He just says that the data isn't conclusive, that the current belief doesn't match up with the facts is all he's saying. Someone even jokes around about being aliens, he's not on board with that.
No, he's more reasonable than that.
Yeah.
But still, he's the misunderstood.
He's misunderstood.
Guy who has like he's got the theory that nobody believes in.
But he's not a crackpot. He's not like out there going, you know, oh, it's a wormhole or any of that.
I think he is a crackpot.
All right.
In academia. He's not a crackpot because he's right. But that's what these movies do. They make him right. And if today the conspiracy theorists are right, that's a dangerous thought. And he's built that up through his entire career, which is why going back, I was like, oh, that's in there. If you write that today, now it's got like a political message to it, which I really dislike. And he's still doing that today. I'm not saying in 94 it was sinister, that it seemed like politically dangerous in the same way that it is today. Nevertheless, it's in there. And James Spader, I mean, this is a movie that nobody wanted to do.
Correct.
In terms of actors. James Spader didn't want to do it. Kurt Russell didn't want to do it. Jay Davidson didn't want to do it.
They were apparently quite a handful on the set, if you read the behind-the-scenes stuff. They were apparently very challenging to work with.
Apparently, and well-treated. You know, I think I could see it both ways.
Okay.
Like, in the end, they changed their voice.
Yep.
Like, they manipulate the performance so that it's like, well, I'm not even really in this movie, but yeah, problems with costumes, problem with doing all the language.
Mm-hmm.
Because this movie, that's one of the things I found pretty bold, is that how much of it had to be subtitled.
Yeah.
People speaking, I guess, ancient Egyptian throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, I mean, I don't know if you saw that, but originally they were going to present the film without subtitles.
Oh gosh, I did not see that part. Okay, no.
And it was they had a disastrous preview.
Yep.
And it was a producer, and not even Emmerich, it was a producer who pushed for it. So we'll just put subtitles on it, and then people will understand what's happening. And that worked. you know. But it's still, for a blockbuster movie like this, that's a lot of reading.
Well, it's interesting too, because like the studio was not behind the film either. Even the studio didn't want to make the movie. The studio was not behind the film. They did not do a big promotional push. This movie succeeded based on word of mouth. That's what made this movie a hit, was all the early screenings. They changed stuff, like you said. They changed that. They also found out Ra was not threatening enough. That's why they added the voice effect. That's why they added the glowing eyes. That was all after the fact, after the first couple screenings as well, to try and make Ra more interesting and more threatening. Again, studio wouldn't put much in the promotional effort, so they were out there doing a grassroots promotion, and then when it came out, it got such a good reception because it's really good that it did so well in the theater. It was like one of the biggest October releases of all time, I think, at the time.
I think at the time it was the highest grossing opening in October, which is like one of the dead months. It's not because it's so good. I mean, it had like popular appeal.
It was good.
It's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. So like James Spader didn't want to do it, right? But like he's been quoted to say he did it to put food on the table, basically. And sometimes you need to work.
Yep.
And I don't know if you can tell that he doesn't really want to be there. I mean, he's not phoning it in.
No, okay. So this is where we don't agree, based on what I picked up early on. I think James Spader's incredible in this movie. He is so nervous and clumsy and not well put together that it becomes insanely charming and like disarming. And you're like, I want this guy to win. He's so... Because I normally can't stand James Spader in a movie. Like, I don't like James Spader in most movies. And this role, I just loved it. I, like, want to give Daniel Jackson a hug. I'm like, oh, come on, man. You can do it. Solve the puzzle. You know? Get the girl.
I think he's not well written in the sense that he's a bit too comical at the top.
Okay.
So, it's like he's supposed to be, like, super competent, absurdly competent. Like, people have been working on this for years, and he just walks in and goes, oh, it's that, mm-hmm. you know? It's a little bit easy. And he's supposed to be a linguist, but he's also, like, doing chicken noises to people so that they can understand that he's talking about something tastes like chicken. Like, it seems, like, so absurd that he would be so competent and then so incompetent.
Well, I think it's the social – it's a distinction of social skills. You can have an incredibly smart person who just does not have the social skills. And both of us, being in the nerd community, I think we've seen this enough where there are certain people in our community that are brilliant but just don't have the social skills that you would expect. And I think that's what we're getting from Daniel.
Well, Spader still found the script to be awful. Kurt Russell thought the script was awful.
Well, okay, the Kurt Russell thing, they actually mailed him the wrong script.
Apparently.
They mailed him the first draft.
Yeah, but I love how that's information that comes from Dean Devlin himself, the writer.
Oh, okay.
You know, I believe it, but also, like, he kept upping his price.
He gets $7 million on a $55 million budget. So Kurt Russell's
a lot.
Is like one-eighth of his cost is one-eighth of the budget of the whole movie.
Good for him.
Exactly. If you're going to do it, get paid, man. Cha-ching.
Yeah, yeah. And the same thing happened with Jay Davidson. You know, like he was hot off The Crying Game,
right.
But hot in all the wrong ways. And in some ways, he had like a very bad experience with public reaction. And so he didn't really want to do another movie. He was a model and didn't want to do that. So the ask was for $1 million. They'll never give me that, you know, and they give him.
I don't think he ever did another movie after this. Like I was reading, like he kind of walked away from Hollywood.
He quit. So he got the $1 million paycheck, and so great. But there are some, what I found so interesting about the casting beyond those three leads is that there are a lot of like faces that were new at the time or came from sitcoms or would be in sitcoms. Mm-hmm. Like French Stewart is in there as Ferrelli, the sort of unprofessional soldier.
French, I mean, that is insane. The goofball from Third Rock from the Sun.
Third Rock from the Sun.
As a hardcore military guy. Like, what?
Yeah. And then you had Richard Kind was part of the ground crew. He was in Mad About You, was in Spin City, like a face, a well-recognizable face from sitcoms. Mm-hmm. And then you had, and in terms of like the new faces, how about Jimon Hounsou?
Right. I know.
Right? He's one of the Egyptian soldiers. Right after that, he did Amistad with Steven Spielberg. And Gladiator was right after that.
He did a bunch of stuff. But, you know, the nerd community, of course, knows him from Guardians of the Galaxy and Shazam, you know, is where we all know him from.
Right. He's in everything now. So a very young Jimon Hounsou in there. So, you know, so some people got their start in this thing.
There's a couple other things. And this isn't necessarily casting, but it kind of is. And this is one of the things I remember in 1994, watching the movie in the theater that impressed me. Was, and again, it's kind of tied to casting, is the number of extras. Like, I remember looking and seeing literally hundreds of extras running down the sand dunes, right, to attack or whatever, or in the backgrounds working. And I'm like, I don't remember, and this is in mid-90s, I'm like, I don't remember seeing a movie with this kind of scope, with this kind of epic size of people, bodies on the screen moving in years. And it just,
you got fooled, though.
Well, okay.
You know, because a lot of those were like cardboard cutouts.
They were. They were scarecrows in the back. But they still had somewhere between 300 to 500 extras.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a huge amount of extras.
I think they were making, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, you know, it was something like that.
That's what it felt like, right. I mean, so watching that, I remember just thinking, wow, I haven't seen, and I'm falling back on the word epic too much, but like it felt very epic to me because of the size of the number of people on the screen. Now, nowadays, that would all be CGI. But to see that many people, it's still impressive. It still gets to you.
And I want to talk about that, the CGI in this. 1994 is pretty early for CG or FX that at least look like CG. But it had elements in there, you know, like those helmets, those bird helmets that the Egyptians wore.
I thought that was practical.
Was it? Anyway, they fold back in,
the retracting,
right?
Yeah.
The retracting.
Right. Yeah.
And now that's in every superhero movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
But I can't name a movie from before 1994, like before this movie, where this was the effect.
Hmm. I know Lost in Space used it, but that was 98.
Like it's an early... Wow. Quote unquote morph, or, you know, it's like it's a very simple CG effect, but
it's very, very effective.
And today it's like an industry standard to do that, to the point where we're going like, really, you know, like Spider-Man's mask has to go click, 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 click.
Right, right.
They did it first, maybe.
Could be. And another thing about the film, before we get into Kurt Russell and all that, but, you know, is the soundtrack. The soundtrack for this film is absolutely incredible. It's compelling. It's exciting. It's adventurous. It harkens back. It feels like those big 1940s adventure flick soundtracks. It got used in all kinds of other trailers from then on. You know, like a lot of times when they make a movie trailer, they don't have a soundtrack yet, so they use somebody else's. They would use this soundtrack over and over in the other people's trailers. For my money, I would say it's one, I'm not going to say the, but one of the best sci-fi soundtracks outside of John Williams. I think it's that good.
Okay.
Are you not there? Okay.
I don't have a feeling either way.
Okay.
Of course, it has those exotic elements that remind you of Egypt, you know, with a little more synth in there, a little more modern sounds in there. So it's certainly interesting, but I can't recall it offhand after watching it like a week ago.
I can't stop humming it. Da, 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 all this. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now you do it, yeah. But it does sound like other scores. So you're probably right that it was reused in trailers and such, you know?
And think about this, too, as far as like what is... part of the reason I think it impressed me so much is like what else is out around this time? So I looked up like mid-90s movies. And I mean, there's some good 90s sci-fi movies. Okay, that's fair. But like mid-90s sci-fi movies are things like Starship Troopers, you know, Mars Attacks, Johnny Mnemonic, Free Jack, Species, Time Cop, Demolition Man. None of those are really at the top of my list for great movies. There may be certain things to love in each one, but they're not. And then you compare it to something like this, you're like, okay, Stargate really stood out as being something new and fresh and interesting and compelling.
Completely different from anything else. It's not different from every movie ever made. In that time, they just weren't making those.
Mm-hmm.
Like the sci-fi was more like dystopian, you know, it was like cyberpunk.
Yep.
There's like those kinds of movies. So if I go back to what I was saying when I was about to compare James Spader and Kurt Russell, okay? So I said, like, at first you think that James Spader is your hero, and he sort of is. I mean, he's your through line throughout the movie. At the end, he's the one that gets the girl, and he's the one, you know, he stays on the planet and so on. Really, at the beginning, Kurt Russell has a very silent character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His character has just lost a child in a gun accident at home. Still topical. And you're thinking maybe he's putting that on himself. Maybe he hadn't stored the weapon correctly. He's a soldier. He should have known better. We don't know the details. But he's depressed to the point of being suicidal. You know, he's coming into this adventure with a death wish.
And I love that he doesn't have any dialogue that says that in there. It's just showing the first shot of him in his son's room crying. Well, actually, I don't even know if he's crying. I can't remember. But he's just haunted. His face is so haunted. And he's just sitting in his son's room holding the gun. And that's when you know, okay, he's thinking about suicide, right? But they don't push it. And it's just, wow, what a incredible establishing shot for that, for Kurt Russell and for that character.
And it's such a serious character performance issue to put in this, which is really a rollicking, you know, space adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that in the middle of it, what happens is he's that character you know, through the first half of the movie. He's planning to blow the Stargate from that side after his team goes back to Earth. And of course, they have to figure out how to reactivate the gate, which causes problems. It's just like a Doctor Who plot where, oh no, the TARDIS is, debris has fallen in front of the TARDIS. I guess we'll go on the adventure. It's kind of like that. But so he's planning to die in this nuclear explosion, destroying the Stargate. Like, he's done. His life is over, basically. And he's going on this mission as one last mission. His men don't even know that's what he's going to do, that that's what the plan is. And then through the adventure, he connects with a boy from the Egyptian culture. And the boy, like, will touch the gun. And, like, he panics. And, you know, that's still part of the character. But he's going to warm to these people. He's going to start laughing. By the end of the movie, he's cracking wise. He's doing the one-liners. So there's a moment, and I think we even seen it on screen, when they both say, I have an idea at the same time.
Yeah.
And by that point, like, they've reached, the two heroes have sort of met in the middle. And I think in one way, the two characters are sort of passing each other as the soldier becomes the hero of this story. And the scientist relegates himself to sidekick, whereas before it was kind of the opposite. Like, star and co-star sort of, whoops.
I hadn't thought about them swapping protagonist roles. I thought more of it like that's when it became a buddy cop show at that point.
That's a good way to see it, yeah.
And in true Kurt Russell fashion, one of the things I like about the Jack O'Neill character is that it's not like Big Trouble in Little China, where it was, you know, you thought he was going to be the action hero and he wasn't. In this one, it's different. He's the action hero, but he's the one who's got it wrong. He is aiming for the wrong thing. And it takes his character to learn, relearn compassion and understand the value of science. And that's how they end up winning the day, is that his character has to change his trajectory. So, again, he comes in as the action hero, but not quite the right action hero.
To me, he's the humanity in the film. That's why I pegged James Spader as more of the... He's the hero, but he's also sort of comic relief at the same time. Mm-hmm. So he's almost too comical to be the heart of the film. And because of the tragedy that O'Neill is feeling, like, he's the heart. He's the one who changes.
Yeah.
Whereas James Spader's character finds a world where he's valued.
Yeah.
He doesn't change.
No, that's fair. You're right. Kurt Russell, whatever. His character is definitely the one that goes on the journey. Yeah.
He's the one that has to change. So I feel like at some point we realize, oh no, he's becoming the protagonist, or he's on the hero's journey as much as, or perhaps even more than Daniel, the James Spader character. You know, I think they do make a mistake with him.
Which one?
Kurt Russell's character. Because I think the character works throughout and is consistent. But the whole idea, the film's idea, that we're going to present a character who has this tragedy, this very specific tragedy in his life. And then later we're going to, even though he's not always on board with it, but he does sometimes is, we're going to present a solution where we're going to put guns in the hands of kids. And that's part of the solution of the movie. That's part of the rebellion against Ra. And I was like, oh, that's really not well thought out.
Well, he doesn't have a role in that because he's in the pyramid.
No, he's angry about it at the beginning. And eventually he's kind of smiling, but still the movie does it.
Right. Okay. Yes. The movie does it because his character is in the basement of the pyramid when the kids get their hands on the guns and rebel. So he doesn't have any part of that other than seeing them with the guns after they've won.
Right. It's like his lieutenant or sergeant, or I don't know what the ranks are.
Kowalski and
Kowalski is the one who does it and is like, he's happy about it.
Yeah.
But by the end of the movie, the kids have guns and they're shooting at the X-wing, and the Egyptian the sort of moon wing. Kind of reminds me, it was like something like Moon Knight would fly.
It does. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. By that point, it just doesn't track anymore. It's like, I feel like the movie doesn't understand the ethics of its own drama.
Yeah.
So that's the mistake they made. But I feel like at the same time, O'Neill is pretty consistent throughout at not liking this, at being against it.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to add more fuel to your director hate, but I'm going to ask a question about something we just talked about, his journey we just talked about, and wondering if the director did not intend a journey, instead just towards the end of the movie, he just let Kurt Russell be Kurt Russell, is what I'm wondering. Because, like, what happens is they're like, once they're sneaking back into the pyramid, right, to deal with the bomb or whatever, Kurt Russell's in disguise, and the bad guys, like, you know, are pulling the hoods down to see who's under the hoods, and they pull his down, and suddenly, rather than being the hard-ass Jack O'Neill, he's Kurt Russell. Because he looks at the guy and goes, how you doing? He like winks or blinks or whatever, and then shoots the dude. And then later you get the part where he does say, you know, give my regards to King Tut, a-hole. And he doesn't say a-hole. He says the word. I'm trying to keep Siskoid's show clean.
I think we can say asshole is pretty.
Okay. He pretty says, tame, give my regards tame. To King Tut, asshole. And it's like, that is such a Kurt Russell line. And so I do wonder, is it that his character went through a journey, or it's just towards the end of the film, they're just like, ah, let's let Kurt Russell be Kurt Russell.
I think there's the journey, and then there's also the transformation into Kurt Russell at the end. So they sort of set us up for this kind of hero, right? But then when you watch the movie, at the beginning you're going, oh, I don't know if Kurt Russell is as a badass as he is in the trailer.
Yeah.
You know, because he's so reserved, he's so embittered, he's sort of like, you know, Batman on the first day or something. He's still stinging from his trauma. So you're thinking, when is he going to become this other character? And I agree. It's a little, do we believe it? Becomes this. At the same time, we're cheering for it, aren't we?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's the big resolution of this adventure movie. Now, I want to go back a bit into the plot you were talking about where he, you know, is against the kids with guns. There's a really well-done scene, and I'll say it was well-written and well-directed. So take that, buddy. Sure. Where it starts off where he is bonding with Scar, Sakaar, whatever the kid's name is. And he's found this young teenage kid. He's starting to feel a father-son connection with him. And they're doing the thing with the smoking the cigarette that is genuinely laugh out loud funny. Because the kid's watching him smoke a cigarette. And the kid like goes and takes a cigarette and decides to light it. And Kurt Russell's seeing all this happen. So Kurt Russell intentionally takes like the deepest drag of a cigarette in the history of film. So that this kid goes, oh, that's what I have to do. And then the kid takes the drag of the cigarette. And of course, he's like coughing. And I mean, the scene is hilariously funny. And that's when the kid reaches for the gun. And that's where the switch flips. And suddenly he does become the protective father who lost his son to a gun accident. And it's the comedy was disarming so that when it happens, it's that much more visceral. And you know that he overreacted and he knows he overreacted. And it's just really well done. It's powerful.
I agree. I completely agree. I mean, that's why I said that the character was pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Like that was the moment that just felt completely natural to the beginning, which is why by the end, when they've got these child soldiers going on, that felt wrong. And I think but maybe the third act is maybe it's like producer notes, and you know how it is. And they had to change things, or they had like, no, we got to make this more marketable. And one of the things that makes it marketable is, you know, badass lines, let's not talk about this downer anymore.
Yeah.
And whether that's in the script from the beginning or if it's a manipulation from the top, or we don't know. But it does feel like the movie sort of forgets some of its issues, you know, to get us to the money shots.
Well, and that's also kind of a not that unusual for a big summer block. I mean, it wasn't summer, but a big blockbuster action film. You know,
but it is a summer blockbuster. You know, it's a summer blockbuster
in October.
In October, yeah.
But it's kind of natural for those big movies that it takes the drama elements, so you connect to the characters, and then by the end, it's like, okay, now we're an action movie, so we're going to leave the drama behind and just have, you know, the big action and the fun and the romance and all that.
And I think one of the things that I've noticed about Kurt Russell's performances in many movies is that he can thread that line. It's believable that he was this dour, traumatized soldier that then he finds like a sort of humor and, you know, the father-son stuff where he's happier. And then by the end that he's doing like the badass stuff, it tracks for me. It may be a little clunky, but I do think it tracks. And when I call him the humanity of this film, it's because he's so natural within even the genre trope, within the, like even the character in Big Trouble in Little China, which was our previous episode, which is completely off the wall.
Right.
There's still moments in there to make you think, was that a put on? You know, was Jack Burton actually more human than this, but it sort of acts like that in a way?
Or
he can have feet of clay. Like in this, he may become the hero at the end that we were wanting him to be. But he still lets the other guy have the girl. I mean, not that that was in play for him. I'm not saying that. But he's married. He's got a wife at home. But still, it's like that those hero moments are denied him. And he's like, he's more than happy to let the other guy have those moments. To have Daniel shine. To be a co-star. I think that's part of his screen persona, personally.
To share the screen and not be the screen hog, you're saying.
There's a lack of ego in Kurt Russell as a screen performer.
And you've talked about that in all the past episodes, and I totally agree. Yeah, from thinking it through, absolutely. I can't think of a film where he was really the only character in the film. There's always somebody else who's, you know, a partner or an equal or someone that's, you know, important to the story. Yeah.
Or he's letting himself, he may be like front and center, but also like play things that might be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like Big Trouble in Little China, yeah. You know, it's like, he can be ridiculous. He can look foolish and still maintain his charisma and, you know, it's fine. So, and in this film, the opposite. To do something so minimalistic.
Yeah. I mean, it's
when people are perhaps expecting a lot more, you know, razzmatazz.
That was one of my notes, was like, he is, for the first half of the film, he's so low key. Like, I couldn't remember a Kurt Russell performance. I mean, Snake Plissken, he's angry. So he's not like happy go lucky, but he's not this quiet. Like you said, it called it earlier, quiet. You know, the soldier, you know, the quiet, reserved soldier. And it was kind of a different performance. I'm sure there's some film out there where he's done that and I'm not thinking of.
Soldier.
God, I don't know if I've ever even seen that one.
I think Soldier is like very minimalistic.
Okay.
He's a human weapon and it's a very minimalistic performance. But, you know, like he's able to do that and then eventually like give us a little comedy, which I think he's also known for.
Well, it could be too. I hadn't thought about this till we talked about Soldier, was going back to the whole idea of just how the character changes in the film. By the second half of the movie, they're in mission. Like, you know, there's a lot, the first half of the movie is a lot of exploring, figuring things out. They don't really have a path. They don't have a course to try to follow at that point because the sandstorm is storm, you know, trapped them and all this. But by the end, there's a mission and he's a soldier and he knows that you have to adapt and overcome. And maybe that's even why he's okay with the kids with guns, because they adapted, they overcame, and that was needed in order to complete the mission. I don't know. Maybe an argument could be made for that. I'm probably no-prizing it. But the most important thing we haven't talked about is that hair, man. That high. I don't even. You can't even call it high and tight. It's high. I don't know. It's not tight. That crazy, really tall flat top that he's got. Has he ever had that kind of haircut in another movie?
Pretty extreme. You can tell there's a look that we're looking for. It's probably a wig.
You think it's a wig? Really?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
For $7 million, I'd shave my head.
Like, it's just so plasticky.
There's a lot of product in there, that's for sure.
Right. It's like really stiff up top. It's like if you had a flat top, but it's just like so high.
Well, I wonder if, like, they said, we need to cut you into, like, a military cut. He's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I'm kind of known for my longest shaggy hair. And they're like, can we meet in the middle or something? I don't know, because it is way too tall to be even remotely illogical for military.
Oh, right. It's probably not. Our military listeners can probably tell us that that's not regulation.
or they'll probably come back and say, actually, there's a lot of flexibility. I don't know. But it looks ludicrous. And I kind of love it because it does.
This is a movie that is also a little bit like a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
So it there are some extremes in terms of looks, whether that's his look or, you know, when the Egyptians, all the stuff with Ra. I mean, that's a very, very distinct, almost comic booky. The pyramid ship, which like sits on top of pyramids. So like, okay, so it means pyramids are actually these podiums that like ships dock into. That's what a pyramid is. So, okay. So, you know, like there's some very interesting stuff in there visually. You know, to use the Egyptian stuff. I mean, the movie was sued for, the production was sued by a high school teacher who said he originated this premise.
Right.
He called it Egyptscape.
They settled out of court, ultimately.
Egyptscape, yeah. So he said he wrote that while he was in college. He had his Egyptology professor vouched for him at the trial, etc. And he said he submitted it to Fox and never heard back. And it's like, this was actually made by Studio Canal. So best I can figure it, like, if there's any truth to this, Fox wasn't going to make it. They sold the rights to Studio Canal, and then it fell into the lap of Emmerich and Devlin. So I don't think it's them stealing a script. It's like that came to them through the production company, you know.
Yeah.
They settled out of court for $50,000. So that sounds like just like, well, here's your salary if you'd submitted it and we paid for it.
Speaking of lawsuits, MGM ought to sue Disney for their Atlantis animated movie, which is essentially a rip-off remake of Stargate.
You said this, you know, off air, and I was like, is it though? I mean, it's got some of the same elements.
Milo is Daniel Jackson. I mean, like, he's so Milo. Milo is so Daniel Jackson. It's ridiculous.
Right, the character, yeah. Sure. And he does get to marry the princess on the other side of... But there's no gate. I mean, it's like, Atlantis is just inside the Earth.
But they're studying ancient technology and the archaeology to find it. And there's I can't remember all the details right now. If you want, folks, Google Stargate and if you Google Stargate Atlantis, you're going to get the TV show Stargate Atlantis. But if you Google Disney Atlantis and all this, you'll find tons of websites and videos and stuff comparing side by side all the different things that it's just a complete ripoff of. It's also apparently Atlantis is also apparently a ripoff of an anime as well. But
yes, the plot is Castle in the Sky.
Yes, that's it.
A Miyazaki film. For me, that's the touchstone much more than Stargate is.
That's fair.
Right. You mentioned Stargate Atlantis. So if you talk about the legacy of this film, is that the one that you had a big fandom for or Stargate Universe?
Stargate Universe. So Stargate SG-1, which was a direct continuation of this, has the Jack O'Neill character, has the Daniel Jackson character, and several other characters they introduced. That one went for 10 years. They introduced kind of their version of DS9, which was Stargate Atlantis, where it's like, okay, we're in another galaxy now. We're, you know, meeting new aliens, all these things. And I watched that for a little while. It didn't do a lot for me. Jason Momoa was kind of got a lot of attention for doing it as well. But then they did SGU, which is Stargate Universe, which unfortunately only went for 2 seasons. And it was the end of the Stargate franchise at that point. And it got horrible following because they tried to do something different. They basically said, all right, let's take the Stargate concept, you know, the gates, all that kind of stuff. Get away from all the aliens they introduced and all the really complicated stuff. Tell our own story, but also mix it with sort of the ideology of Battlestar Galactica. So they end up, they're on a ship, a little lost in space as well. They're on a ship on the other side of the universe. The humans are stuck there. The ship is falling apart. Every week there's some kind of crisis. You know, like, you know, they don't have air to breathe. They've got to solve that. They don't have food is another one. They don't have water is another one. Like, there's all these, every episode, they're just on the brink of death. And it was filmed more like the BSG remake, you know, very intense, edge of your seat, white knuckle the whole time. It's incredible. And the problem was it never found an audience because...
Did it have Stargates?
It had Stargates, yes. So there was a Stargate on the ship that they would jump through to go to nearby planets and stuff. It was really compelling and very fascinating and interesting, and the drama was just ratcheted up to 11. But it never found an audience because the Stargate fans were like, this is completely different. This is like nothing. It's not. I mean, it didn't break continuity, but just the style of film. The other Stargate stuff's like popcorn sci-fi. It's fun. It's goofy. You know,
episodic. Yeah, yeah. The usual.
This was again like Battlestar Galactica. You know, heavy, oppressive. You know, scary, claustrophobic. And so the Stargate fans didn't like it. Then the rest of the world, who it should have appealed to, said, just like you said, oh, there's 10 years of Stargate already. I don't know what this is. I'm not going to start with this one. And so no one came to it. But damn, I mean, I have only watched a few things all the way through multiple times. Firefly and Stargate Universe, the only things I can think of where I have sat down and watched from end to end probably 3 times. It is that damn good.
It helps that they're short, right?
Well, it had like 40 episodes or so. So it's, I mean, there's a lot. Because they had, it's like the old model of like, you know, 22 episodes a season or whatever. So it does make it easier, sure. But it's still like 40 hours of your life watching it. But I cannot recommend enough for y'all to try Stargate Universe. It's incredible. In fact, I didn't find out till after I finished watching it like the third time that the creative consultant on the science fiction aspects of it is John Scalzi, who's one of my favorite sci-fi writers right now.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's a recommendation. Like, we don't need to watch any other shows. No, you can jump into Universe without watching the other ones.
Correct. Okay. I mean, they'll certainly reference other stuff, but all the context clues are there. You'll understand what's going. I mean, if you've seen the first movie, that's enough. How the gates work. You go from, you know, you got to dial the gate and you go jump through and you come out somewhere else. That's all you need to know.
All right. When all said and done, let's use the Gillis and Doran formula for Podcast de la Vista, baby. And I will ask you, is Stargate a good movie?
I think my answer is pretty how much on Front Street. Yes, I think Stargate is a very good movie.
And I don't think it's a good movie. It's an okay movie.
Okay.
So I don't have the same love for it. But
is it a fun movie?
I think it's got some really good bits. Mm-hmm. I think it ends better than it started. But is Stargate a good Kurt Russell movie? That's the real question.
Do I have to go first? Because I'm struggling on this one. Because like I started thinking, I guess I am going first. If they replace Kurt Russell with another actor, would the movie be as compelling? And because Kurt Russell has such a minimalist role, I do wonder if a different actor could have pulled it off. And the movie would still be that unaltered. You know, would be not that different. Mm. So... Now, Kurt Russell brings a lot to it, especially when, you know, they let Kurt Russell be Kurt Russell by the end. So is it a good... I would say, yes, it's a Kurt Russell movie, but someone else probably could have done it. Well, I mean, like Big Trouble in Little China, no one else could have pulled that off. I mean, there's very few people that could have pulled off that character, you know?
Right.
That's what I'm
right.
saying. Is like, I think there's a lot of people that probably could have pulled off Jack O'Neill.
Probably. I will say it is a good Kurt Russell movie. I mean, he's one of the two stars, mm-hmm. right? So you're watching it in part for him. He does get to do the things he does best. Both the badassery and then those more like subtle acting, letting other people have a go, which I think is a big part of the humanity he brings to those scenes with the kids, is also, I think, a very important. I mean, there's a reason this guy was cast as Santa Claus eventually.
Are you going to do those someday?
Yes, DJ Nut is already there for the Yay! Christmas episode. It's going to be Christmas Chronicles.
Those are surprisingly good.
Like, how can he sell that? How can he be that character? You know, I think he's got like a warm smile that make, even though he can be like, maybe like this intense, violent person, like in Tombstone, which we covered already on the mm-hmm. show, the moments where he smiles and is human and is like disarming, he can bring that out, even though like he has like this very hard exterior shell. You can see it melt. And I think that's part of like that smile is part of his appeal to audiences. It's like he's the guy that's, you kind of want to be him in a way. You're kind of scared of him, but then he smiles and says, oh no, like I could be friends with this guy.
It's that Kurt Russell charm.
It's that Kurt Russell charm. And I think it's in here along with various different colors of performance. So yes, I'm going to say it is a good Kurt Russell movie.
That makes me very happy. Oof.
All right, well.
I was afraid I was going to trash your show like on the fourth or fifth episode.
No. I mean, there's room for, really appreciated your enthusiasm, even though this was not like necessarily one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. Thanks for indulging in some WrestleMania with me today, Shag. Tell the folks where they can find you and what you're working on right now.
Sure. You can find me on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, on all the social medias as well, mostly as Once Upon a Geek. On the network, you can find me doing the Justice League International Bwahaha podcast for a few more months. Once that show wraps, I'm going to ratchet up my JSA in the 90s show over on the Justice Society Presents feed. So it'll be a monthly show going into covering JSA comics from the 90s. And more tied to this, and I believe I had the timing right on when this is released, I just released an episode of my Once Upon a Geek show that was all about military science fiction novels. So if you like Stargate, which is, I would argue, very much a military sci-fi movie, this would dovetail nicely. So military sci-fi over on Once Upon a Geek. We talk about military sci-fi novels.
It's going to be super interesting. I'll let you go back to the theater. We'll play a trailer, and I'll be back with your feedback on our previous episode in which Dr. Ange and I discussed Big Trouble in Little China.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
And now feedback on our previous episode in which Dr. Ange and I discussed Big Trouble in Little China. A lot of nice comments, actually, showing that this movie left a nice footprint on popular culture. Alexander Osias says, on Kim Cattrall as Gracie Law. I'd like to point out that Law is a common Chinese name. Sure, it's transliterated from different surnames, but if the name needs to be rendered in the English alphabet, you do what you need to do. She could have been a role originally for a Chinese or Asian character, or maybe a half-Asian one. It's a double trope. Asian kids forced to become a doctor or a lawyer by parents, and the Asian-American activist driven to push for the rights of their ethnicity. It's an interesting point. As a kid, I remember thinking that Jack was going to be on a hero's journey. I didn't know that mythological or storytelling construct yet, but I did feel like he was going to be a naive hero guided by the experienced heroes and then become the kick-ass champion at the end after a compressed amount of training and experience. As I began to watch, I did realize that he was less that and more of a sidekick, but one with a sense of justice and loyalty to Wang and even some of the other characters. On the friendship between Wang and Jack, I wavered between thinking that they were either really close friends, hence the instant loyalty when Wang's girlfriend gets kidnapped, or not so close friends, but Jack's just a stand-up guy who isn't gonna let his drinking buddy's fiancée get kidnapped right in front of him and let the criminals get away with it. After all, he stepped in to help Gracie's friend Tara, who was being assaulted by a gang member, without really knowing Gracie or Tara. High time for a rewatch with my son, I think. Brian Schufo says, for years that my brain conflated Big Trouble in Little China with the Jack Nicholson movie Chinatown. So when I rented this movie, I was so confused to the point where I don't think I finished it before having to return the VHS tape back to Blockbuster. Forget it, Brian. It's not Chinatown. Chris Pine says, man, I love this movie. I love it so much that I have a hard time trusting people who don't like it. Like my wife. If that's even her real name. I'm pretty sure my first experience with Big Trouble was either a video rental or an airing on one of the non-Big Three TV networks. And for 12-year-old Piney, this was a perfect movie. It had everything you needed a film to have at that time for kids my age. It was action, martial arts, fantasy, comic books, video games, etc. And while Jack was a kind of parody of an action hero, the movie itself never played as a parody. It never felt like it was laughing at the audience for liking movies like this, but that it invited you in to laugh along with it. And I don't think the rewatchability survives on nostalgia alone. Big Trouble has the ability to evolve with you as you get older. Now at my age, instead of the action and spectacle, I can appreciate the humor and, I guess, what you would call the deconstruction of the action hero. But I'm biased, so I could just be making an excuse to watch a movie with a guy that has lightning hands. Having listened to you both discuss the movie, I started to wonder if Jack was putting on a persona and behaving in the way he thinks a macho guy should. He's nearly a caricature in a lot of the film. This tank top wearing, John Wayne sounding, knife throwing, speech making truck driver. Almost like a 14-year-old's idea of what tough is. I don't think the movie goes that deep with it, but it shows us an interesting contrast of what, say, Americans like Jack think of as being a man and how the rest of the world Jack lives in defines that. Even Jack himself has moments where things sink in and his bravado fades a bit as he grapples with some of the stuff that is going on around him. Chris Franklin says, I introduced Big Trouble to my son when he was recovering from pneumonia. He later asked me if the movie was real because he was pretty sure it was a fever dream. I think that's a pretty accurate description. Brian Linton says, Big Trouble in Little China is quite possibly my favorite Kurt Russell film. It's certainly the one I've seen the most times. I really enjoyed both of your insights into the main character as sidekick aspect of the story, which I'd never fully picked up on before. One of the reasons that I like Jack is that he always appeared to be such an ineffective hero. I just never made the final leap to realizing that he isn't actually the hero of the story, so thank you for that eye-opener. Now I just need to figure out a way to convince my family to watch it with me so that I can impress them with everything that I learned from this episode. I will, of course, cite my references. Rocky Starwind, who dressed as Jack Burton for Halloween last year, asks, has anyone read the comics they made for this series? Yeah, I did a few years ago. I remember liking it, but it's been a while. It came out from Boom Studios, and I, at that time, 2014, I was writing reviews of, like, short capsule reviews for my comic book store and their website, just on the number one issues, just the, like, the introductory issues of series. So I just dragged this down. Here's what I said about Big Trouble in Little China. It's by John Carpenter, Eric Powell, and Brian Shirilla. The continuing adventures of Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, as it's subtitled, is a straight sequel to the cult Carpenter film, and even if you only remember it vaguely, it's not hard to get into at all. Like the film, it's an anything-goes demonic kung fu tale starring a pretty good likeness of Kurt Russell, and it's fun. Not only do the heroes return, but even the threat is direct from the movie, as new villains show up to take revenge. It's kung fu guys, it's expected, and just to add complications, Jack inherits a demon familiar for his trouble. Keep reading? It's making me want to watch the movie again sooner rather than later. Okay, on to Doug Adamson says, I remember Kim Cattrall and her green eyes and then realizing she didn't have green eyes. I also remember thinking she'd be a great Lois Lane back in the day, so maybe That was who she was channeling in this performance. I remember James Hong and Victor Wong, who also both showed up in The Golden Child, which I remember seeing and regretting it. But most of all, I remember Kurt Russell having a blast as Jack Burton. Thank you for covering this classic slice of action comedy adventure fantasy. There really hasn't been a film like this since. One line that got me thinking was about how Jack broadcasts his thoughts on CB to whoever's listening to him while he's out trucking. And I realized if they remake this somehow, Jack Burton Jr. or whoever will be a podcaster. All right, on that note, Siskoid Cinema's No Escape from Kurt Russell is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So if you're listening to this and have your own opinions on what we've discussed, please feel free to head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com to leave a comment. I'll read them on our next episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts.